readers, welcome to the Book Report. I'm your host, Elaine Charles, and my goal today is to get your summer reading list in tip-top shape. Memorial Day is just ahead. Summer vacation looms for one and all. This week, we'll preview some titles that are pure fun and frippery, and some that are more serious but extremely timely. All are worthy of your consideration. So, to help you decide which will be packed in your beach bag, we'll get started right now.
Traditional advertising can be expensive and wasteful. But lately, you've been hearing a lot about social media and viral marketing. But let's be honest, it's confusing. That's why you need Magic Buzz, a new marketing company so unique, we've even coined a special phrase for what we do. Socio-viral. We combine the word-of-mouth friendliness of social media, like Facebook, Twitter, together with the viral reach power of YouTube, to create the socio-viral effect. The Magic Buzz team makes sure our clients are well represented online. We recently took word-of-mouth advertising to the number one position as most productive medium for a major cell phone company. That's right. Magic Buzz produced more sales than an expensive TV campaign at a fraction of the cost. Put the power of socio-viral marketing to work for you. Visit us at magicbuzz.com. MagicBuzz.com. If you have any questions, please feel free to email us at info@magicbuzz.com. Magic Buzz. We're there when you can't be.
Readers, I gotta confess, I loved watching Matthew McConaughey as the, dare I say, fight the Taliban. Perhaps he wasn't sleazy. Let's just say a guy with somewhat shaky ethics. And it wasn't just because I appreciate looking at Matthew the Bod McConaughey. Nope. Michael Connelly writes his characters with charm and their fair share of warts. Now, in The Fifth Witness, Mickey Haller is back, and readers everywhere are just plain loving this book. Mickey has fallen on tough times. To cope, he expands his business into foreclosure defense, only to see one of his clients accused of killing the banker she blames for trying to take away her home. Mickey puts the team into high gear to exonerate his client, even though the evidence and his own suspicions tell him his client just may be guilty. Soon after he learns the victim had black market dealings of his own, Haller is assaulted too. Then he's certain he's on the right trail. Despite the danger and uncertainty, Haller mounts the best defense of his career in a trial where the last surprise comes after the verdict is in. Whether you're a Connelly fan, a courtroom drama fan, or just a fan of addictive novels, you're going to love this read. It's narrated by Peter Giles.
Mrs. Pena had explained earlier that the mortgage payments she had stopped making 9 months ago had been $700 a month. She would continue to withhold payments to the bank while I worked the case. She would have a free ride for as long as I kept the bank at bay, so there was money to be made here. Make it $250 a month. I'll give her the cut rate plan. Make sure she knows she's getting a deal and that she can never be late with the payments. We can take a credit card if she has one with any juice on it. Just make sure it doesn't expire until at least 2012. Rojas translated, with more gestures and many more words than I had used, while I pulled my phone. The text had come from Lorna Taylor. Call me ASAP. I'd have to get back to her after the client conference. A typical practice would have an office manager and receptionist, but I didn't have an office other than the back seat of my Lincoln, so Lorna ran the business end of things and answered the phones at the West Hollywood condo she shared with my chief investigator. My mother was Mexican-born, and I understood her native language better than I ever let on. When Mrs. Pena responded, I knew what she said, the gist of it, at least. But I let Rojas translate it all back to me anyway. She promised to go inside the house to get the $1,000 cash retainer and to dutifully make the monthly payments. To me, not the bank. I figured that if I could extend her stay in the house to a year, my take would be $4,000 total. Not bad for what was entailed. I would probably never see Mrs. Pena again. I would file a suit challenging the foreclosure and stretch things out. The chances were I wouldn't even make a court appearance. My young associate would do the courthouse legwork. Mrs. Pena would be happy, and so would I. Eventually, though, the hammer would come down. It always does. I thought I had a workable case, even though Mrs. Pena would not be a sympathetic client. Most of my clients stop making payments to the bank after losing a job or experiencing a medical catastrophe. Mrs. Pena stopped when her three sons went to jail for selling drugs and their weekly financial support abruptly ended. Not a lot of goodwill to be had with that story. But the bank had played dirty. I had looked up her file on my laptop. It was all there, a record of her being served with notices involving demands for payment and then foreclosure. Only Mrs. Pena said she had never received these notices, and I believed her. It wasn't the kind of neighborhood where process servers were known to roam freely. I suspected that the notifications had ended up in the trash, and the server had simply lied about it. If I could make that case, then I could back the bank off Mrs. Pena with the leverage it would give me. That would be my defense, that the poor woman was never given proper notice of the peril she was in. The bank took advantage of her, foreclosed on her without allowing her the opportunity to make up the arrears, and should be rebuked by the court for doing so. "Okay, we have a deal," I said. "Tell her to go in and get the money while I print out a contract and receipt. We'll get going on this today." I smiled and nodded at Mrs. Pena. Rojas translated and then jumped out of the car to go around and open her door. Once Mrs. Pena left the car, I opened the Spanish contract template on my laptop and typed in the necessary names and numbers. I sent it to the printer that sat on an electronics platform on the front passenger seat. I then went to work on the receipt for funds to be deposited into my client trust account. Everything was above board, always. It was the best way to keep the California bar off my ass. I might have a bulletproof car, but it was the bar I most often checked for over my shoulder. It had been a rough year for Michael Holler and Associates, attorneys at law. Criminal defense had virtually dried up in the down economy. Of course, crime wasn't down. In Los Angeles, crime marched on through any economy. But the paying customers were few and far between. It seemed as though nobody had money to pay a lawyer. Consequently, the public defender's office was busting at the seams with cases and clients while guys like me were left starving. I had expenses and a 14-year-old kid in private school who talked about USC whenever the subject of colleges came up. I had to do something, and so I did what I had once held as unthinkable. I went civil. The only growth industry in the law business was foreclosure defense.
Nora Roberts' new book, Chasing Fire, is hot, hot, hot. Little else in life is as dangerous as fire jumping, flying past towering pillars of smoke, parachuting down to the edge of an all-consuming blaze, shoveling and sawing for days, all to hold the line and push back against the raw power of Mother Nature. The Missoula Smoke Jumpers are one of the most exclusive firefighting squads in the country. The job is in Rowan Tripp's blood. Her father is a legend. She has been fighting fires since she was 18. At this point, returning to the wilds of Montana for the season feels like coming home, even though this year it's laced with sad, lingering reminders of a partner she lost in the past season. Enter Gulliver Curry, a hotshot firefighter who seems to be one big contradiction. He came to Missoula to follow in the footsteps of Lucas Iron Man Tripp, Rowan's dad, but he's instantly more fascinated by his hero's daughter. Everything is thrown off balance when a dark presence lashes out against Rowan, looking to blame someone for last year's tragedy. Rowan believes any distractions could be lethal, but she needs to find someone she can lean on, or her life may go down in flames. Rebecca Lohman narrates.
His fingers tapped, tapped, tapped on his knee. She does more than giggle. "You're a dog, Romeo." He tipped back his head, let out a series of sharp barks that made her laugh. "Make sure Dolly doesn't find out you're out howling," she commented. She knew, everyone knew, he'd been banging one of the base cooks like a drum all season. "I can handle Dolly." The tapping picked up pace. "Gonna handle Dolly." "Okay," Rowan thought. Something bent out of shape there, which was why smart people didn't bang or get banged by people they worked with. She gave him a little nudge because those busy fingers concerned her. "Everything okay with you, farm boy?" His pale blue eyes met hers for an instant, then shifted away while his knees did a bounce under those drumming fingers. "No problems here. It's gonna be smooth sailing like always. I just need to get down there." She put a hand over his to still it. "You need to keep your head in the game, Jim."
"It's there. Right there. Look at her, swishing her tail," he said. "Once us Zulies get down there, she won't be so sassy. We'll put her down, and I'll be making time with Lucille tomorrow night."
Unlikely, Rowan thought to herself. Her aerial view of the fire put her gauge at a solid 2 days of hard, sweaty work. And that was if things went their way. Rowan reached for her helmet, nodded toward their spotter. "Getting ready. Stay chilly, farm boy."
"I'm ice."
Cards, so dubbed as he carried a pack everywhere, wound his way through the load of 10 jumpers and equipment to the rear of the plane, attached the tail of his harness to the restraining line. Even as Card shouted out the warning to guard their reserves, Rowan hooked her arm over hers. Cards, a tough-bodied vet, pulled the door open to a rush of wind tainted with smoke and fuel. As he reached for the first set of streamers, Rowan set her helmet over her short crown of blonde hair, strapped it, adjusted her face mask. She watched the streamers doing their colorful dance against the smoke-stained sky. Their long strips kicked in the turbulence, spiraled toward the southwest, seemed to roll, to rise, then caught another bounce before whisking into the trees. Cards called, "Right!" into his headset, and the pilot turned the plane. The second set of streamers snapped out, spun like a kid's wind-up toy. The strips wrapped together, pulled apart, then dropped onto the tree-flanked patch of the jump site. "The wind line's running across that creek, down to the trees and across the site," Rowan said to Jim. Over her, the spotter and pilot made more adjustments, and another set of streamers snapped out into the slipstream.
"It's got a bite to it."
"Yeah, I saw."
Jim swiped the back of his hand over his mouth before strapping on his helmet and mask.
"Take her to 3,000, Card shouted.
"Jump altitude." As first man, first stick, Rowan rose to take position. "About 300 yards of drift," she shouted to Jim, repeating what she'd heard Cards telling the pilot. "But there's that bite. Don't get caught downwind."
"Not my first party."
She saw his grin behind the bars of his face mask, confident, even eager. But something in his eyes, she thought. Just for a flash. She started to speak again, but Cards, already in position to the right of the door, called out,
"Are you ready?"
"We're ready," she called back.
"Hook up."
Rowan snapped the static line in place.
"Get in the door."
She dropped to sitting, legs out in the wicked slipstream, body leaning back. Everything roared. Below her extended legs, fire ran in vibrant red and gold. There was nothing but the moment. Nothing but the wind and fire and the twist of exhilaration and fear that always, always surprised her.
"Did you see the streamers?"
"Yeah."
"You see the spot?"
She nodded, bringing both into her head, following those colorful strips to the target. Cards repeated what she'd told Jim, almost word for word. She only nodded again, eyes on the horizon, letting her breath come easy, visualizing herself flying, falling, navigating the sky down to the heart of the jump spot.
Welcome, readers. We are talking today with Dan Weiss, publisher at large at St. Martin's Press, and he is one of the people responsible for the new publication of Sweet Valley Confidential, which, unless you've been living under a rock, has made quite a stir in the publishing world. So welcome, Dan. Thanks so much for being with us today.
My pleasure.
Dan, I know this seems hard to believe, but for some of the readers who aren't so familiar with the history of the series, could you give us a little background, and then we'll start talking about the new title?
Sure. Well, the first Sweet Valley High, which was a teen series, was published in 1983. And the series was a teen phenomenon, kind of the same way Harry Potter was a couple of years back. Sweet Valley High was the first of these big, big publishing fans. And over the course of about 20 years, about 600 titles in various Sweet Valley series were published. Sweet Valley High was the anchor series. There was Sweet Valley Twins and Sweet Valley Kids for younger children, Sweet Valley University for older kids. So there were about 600 titles published in four or five different series around the world. And while we don't really have a real count, domestically, I think Sweet Valley High sold about 150 million units, and around the world, probably another 100 million units. And it lasted for about 20 years, and there was a TV show made of it that was played around the world on and off for about 10 years. We think it's probably still playing somewhere in Kazakhstan or someplace like that. But it was an enormous, enormous success in the early 80s and early 90s.
And tell us a little bit about Francine Pascal, who I understand is 72 now.
Francine Pascal created Sweet Valley High, and she created it because she felt that the time was right for a teen soap opera where the characters themselves, and the characters are the twin girls, Jessica and Elizabeth Wakefield, these perfect blonde twins, where the girls drove the action, and she felt that that was a very empowering and appealing idea. She created a Bible for the series, which was kind of an overview of the mythical place Sweet Valley, and it takes place in a perfect Southern California locale. She created all the characters, and she wrote every single one of the outlines for the 600 titles. The manuscripts were then created under her supervision, and they were written by a pool of ghostwriters who wrote to an outline and who wrote to the specs of the Bible, pretty much the way television is done in a TV series. You know, there's a head writer and a Bible, and parts are parsed out to various writers, and that's how it was done. She is 72, and a very youthful 72, I might add, and has both daughters who are, I guess they're middle-aged now, and grandchildren who are in the demo, and so she stays quite current.
And she also herself worked on a TV soap and Broadway show, George
M. Yes, she did. She was one of the creative consultants of the TV show, and she also is involved in Broadway. She's actually on the Tony Committee. Her brother, Michael Stewart, was a playwright. He wrote Bye Bye Birdie and Hello Dolly and many others, and as his executor, she now is the creative director of his copyrights, which are played around the world constantly. Bye Bye Birdie is always in production somewhere, and in the theater world, Francine has the final word on the productions.
And
she's quite involved in the theater.
She wrote other young adult series, is that correct, including Fearless?
She wrote Fearless after Sweet Valley, and she also wrote some very well-received YA novels, and she's written a couple of adult books as well.
Uh-huh. Okay. All right. So now let's just plunge right in and talk about Sweet Valley Confidential. What a storm of publicity. Tell us about it.
Well, Sweet Valley Confidential, first of all, is the same characters that are featured in Sweet Valley High at 16, but now they're 27 and all grown up. And a lot of the interest is the kids who read those books years ago have also grown up, and they're very curious to know what happened to those characters as adults. And so Francine created this novel to kind of continue the story of these characters as adults. And as adults, they've changed quite a bit, not a surprise. And their lives aren't as perfect as they were years ago. It's much more about jobs and romance and things that are much more adult. And Sweet Valley Confidential continues that story. The outpouring of interest in Sweet Valley Confidential took us a little bit by surprise, but I guess not that much. There have been fan sites related to Sweet Valley High all these years, and they're very, very active. And when we announced Sweet Valley Confidential, which was almost a year ago, the fan sites really took the thing viral. And so we started with the fan sites and built a real online promotion campaign beginning about a year ago when the book was acquired. And over the course of the year, until the book was published, we we as publishers kept feeding morsels to the hungry crowds, including a first chapter and the jacket and bits and pieces of information and contests. And by the time the book was published, there was an enormous pent-up demand for the book. We have about 35,000 friends on Facebook. We had a tremendous number of people following the book on Twitter. And the cover release was a huge attraction on CNN when it was released. We released some videos that went viral. So by the time the book was published, there was an enormous appetite for the book. And when the book was published, in its first week, it became number 14 on the New York Times adult bestseller list.
So is this kind of digital strategy new for the publishing world, or had there been other precedents?
Well, there have been other precedents. I think it's not new any longer, and I think publishers these days are using digital promotion and digital strategies quite routinely. I think what was different about Sweet Valley, in part, was that we were cultivating an existing digital fan base. It wasn't as though we were creating a community for a new property. Community existed, and what we did was tap into it and build on it. But digital marketing is not new these days. It's actually very, very potent and very, very important in publishing in general.
So now that the book is out there, and certainly the copies are being sold, describe the reactions of loyal readers.
Well, the reactions have been mixed. Unsurprisingly, there have been some criticisms that the diehard fans were either angry or disappointed that these characters that they grew up with grew up.
Right.
You know, one of the characters has sex, and they were very concerned about that, you know?
Mm-hmm.
And some of the characters who used to be perfect and sweet are now not quite so.
Yeah.
And so there was quite a bit of criticism from the diehard fans that Francine confounded their expectations.
Yeah.
And on the other hand, I would say just as many people were delighted with the book because they saw it as a fun read and an opportunity to return to their childhood and enjoy it for what it was.
So now is Francine already working on, you know, book number two in the series?
Well, that's not actually really known at the moment, to tell you the truth. We're hoping she is, and we're hoping that there'll be another event. But at the moment, she hasn't committed to it yet.
Okay. Now, I know you personally are working on bringing out more books for the 20-somethings.
That's right.
You feel is an underserved reading population. So what's next for them?
Well, we have acquired a number of fiction and nonfiction projects, and fiction is in some ways similar to the Sweet Valley project, where an author is creating a series of novels based on four or five friends who are going to be moving into a dilapidated brownstone in hip downtown Brooklyn. And if you imagine that as, you know, friends in hip Williamsburg, that's one thing that we're doing.
Yes.
We're doing another novel, which is a very humorous novel about a young woman who is swept up by a socialite and is drawn into a jet-set socialite world, whereas this jet-setter may actually turn out to be her fairy godmother.
Oh, that sounds great. I want to read that, and I'm a bit older than a 20-something.
Very, very amusing. And some of the nonfiction we're doing is also for this demo. We're doing a book called Working Girl, which is how to have a fabulous life for under $30,000 a year.
Kind of like Europe on $5 a day,
that's
only
exactly
updated.
Right.
Okay.
And another book that we're doing, a bit more serious, is an inside account of a company called Groupon, which is this big online discount coupon phenomenon.
Yeah.
And we have an inside account of that, and we're doing a bunch of others. So we're trying to create projects and acquire projects that will be of interest to the 20-something crowd.
Well, thank you, Dan. You have certainly, I'm sure, exceeded all expectations in your mission with this book, and we'll be looking forward to the next.
Thank you so much. I appreciate the opportunity.
All right. Thanks, Dan.
Thank you.
Sweet Valley Confidential, 10 years later, is all grown up from the wildly popular young adult series by Francine Pascal. 10 years after graduating from Sweet Valley High, the Wakefield twins have had a falling out of epic proportion. When Jessica commits what can only be considered a complete and utter betrayal, Elizabeth flees to New York to escape and immerse herself in her lifelong dream of becoming a reporter. But her rift with Jessica is never far from her mind, and even putting 3,000 miles between them can't dull the pain. Elizabeth decides the only way to heal her own heart is to get revenge on her sister. She was always the good twin, the one getting her headstrong sister out of trouble, but now she's about to turn the tables. Author Francine Pascal finally unfolds the continuing story of Elizabeth and Jessica Wakefield and the whole gang from Sweet Valley as they navigate the very grown-up world of love, friendship, careers, and sisterhood. This new novel is creating quite a sensation. The book is narrated by January Lavoie.
Lizzie, pick up. The woman's voice on the machine was plaintive. Please. I really need to talk to you. Of course, Elizabeth could hear it from the kitchen. Could she ever miss that voice? Now so sweet, so seductive, pleading softly, spreading out the vowels almost song-like. Lizzie. That voice, so heavy with love. Love me, it said. Forgive me, so I can put you out of the way and get back to my own life. I forgot to fill the ice tray, but the wine's really cold. Elizabeth's voice was so calm, David thought maybe she hadn't heard the message.
It sounds important. Don't you want to get it?
Now Elizabeth was back in the room, carrying two glasses of chilled white wine. David was sitting on the small, low couch, so low his knees almost obscured his face. She answered him completely composed, as if she were reciting dialogue in a play. Actually, no.
It had everything but the English accent.
David's cheeks creased in a slightly embarrassed smile that pulled in his breath with a little hiss. He was politely uncomfortable, knowing he had stumbled into something too personal.
Sorry.
That's okay. Forget it. She brushed it off, but there was no way to hide her flushed face.
I have to tell you, it's really weird, he said.
Because I didn't take the call?
No, because the voice... It sounded just like you.
No wonder. How many times over the years had she herself been fooled by a recording? For just a flash, she would think, was that me? Or worse, when she had to pick herself out of a family picture. How pathetic is it not to recognize yourself? Elizabeth handed David his wine without comment, put hers down on the low table next to her least favorite chair, comfortable but covered in a scratchy plaid fabric. Normally, she never sat there, but the choice was either next to David on the love seat, which would surely be more intimate than she felt right now, or the scratchy chair. She wasn't in the scratchy chair 2 seconds before she bobbed up and reached for the stereo, which, because the room was so small, was within arm's distance. You like Beyoncé?
Really? He said. I mean, you could have fooled me. It was identical.
He wasn't going to let it go so easily. Instead of the scratchy chair, Elizabeth sat back down next to David on the love seat, making the only move that could detour the direction of the conversation, a direction she seriously didn't want. Certainly not with this semi-stranger, a guy she'd barely spoken to before tonight. Her boss. It worked. He turned to her, delighted, a little surprised at the possible gift he was not expecting, all thoughts of the telephone message wiped out of his head. They worked together at the online magazine Show Survey, Off-Broadway in New York, a weekly struggling along with only a smattering of sponsors and even fewer paid advertisements. It was put out by a passionate staff of 3 dedicated theater lovers and the newcomer, Elizabeth Wakefield. The printed copy left at hotels was not much better than a throwaway, but Elizabeth was grateful to be part of the venture. Not having much experience in theater, she'd lucked into the job 8 months ago after 2 frantic days in New York, one of which, the worst, was her 27th birthday. She celebrated alone, then lied to her parents that she'd spent the day with a couple of old friends from Sweet Valley who had moved to New York. Her mother asked who they were, but when Elizabeth sidestepped the question, she very kindly and wisely didn't pursue it. In fact,
Her parents had been very gentle and understanding, never asking the wrong questions. Even the two times they came to see her in New York, they only talked about her work. Actually, it was David who had hired her. He and his partner, Don Barron, both in their early 30s, both trained accountants who hated the confinement of numbers. Both theater enthusiasts had self-financed Show Survey about 2 years ago as a kind of Zagat ratings guide for off-Broadway. No critics, just audiences. Elizabeth was hired to interview people coming out of the theater and write up paragraph descriptions of shows, just as Zagat did for restaurants. There wasn't enough staff money for Elizabeth to see all the shows, so they had arranged to buy tickets the day of the show at the TKTS booth on 47th Street, and only the cheapest ones at that, and only for shows without an intermission. If there was an intermission, Elizabeth would sneak in free for the second act. Though she worried in the beginning, she never once got caught.
By his early 30s, Paul Allen was a world-famous billionaire, and that was just the beginning. In 2007 and 2008, Time named Paul Allen, the co-founder of Microsoft, one of the 100 most influential people in the world. Since he made his fortune, his impact has been felt in science, technology, business, medicine, sports, music, and philanthropy. His passion, curiosity, and intellectual rigor, combined with the resources to launch and support new initiatives, have literally changed the world. In 2009, Allen discovered that he had lymphoma, lending urgency to his desire to share his story. In this long-awaited memoir, Idea Man, Allen explains how he solves problems, what he's learned from his many endeavors, both triumphs and failures, and his compelling vision for the future. The book also features previously untold stories about everything from the true origins of Microsoft to Allen's role in the dawn of private space travel and in discoveries at the frontiers of brain science. With honesty, humor, and insight, Allen tells the story of a life of ideas made real. The title is narrated by Sean Runnette.
Before these new chips arrived on the scene, it took dozens or hundreds of integrated circuits to perform one narrow function, from traffic lights to gas pumps to printer terminals. Microwave oven-sized mini-computers, the machines that bridged mainframes and the microcomputers yet to come, followed the same formula: one chip, one purpose. But Hoff's invention was far more versatile. As Gordon Moore noted, "Now we can make a single chip and sell it for several thousand different applications." In November 1971, Moore and Robert Noyce, the co-inventor of the integrated circuit, introduced the Intel 4004 microchip at a price of $200. The launch advertisement in Electronic News proclaimed a new era of integrated electronics. Few people took notice of the 4004 early on, but I was a college freshman that year and had time to read every magazine and journal around. It was a fertile period for computers, with new models coming out almost monthly. When I first came across the 4004, I reacted like an engineer. What cool things could you do with this? At first glance, Intel's new chip looked like the core of a really nice calculator. But as I read on, I could see that it had all the digital circuitry of a true central processing unit, or CPU, the brains of any computing machine. The 4004 was no toy. Unlike application-specific integrated circuits, it could execute a program from external memory. Within the limits of its architecture, the world's first microprocessor was more or less a computer on a chip, just as the ad said. It was the first harbinger of the day when computers would be affordable for everyone. 4 months later, as I continued to follow the chips, I came across the inevitable next step. In March 1972, Electronics announced the Intel 8008. Its 8-bit architecture could handle far more complex problems than the 4004, and it addressed up to 16,000 16K bytes of memory, enough for a fair-size program. The business world saw the 8008 as a low-budget controller for stoplights or conveyor belts. In that vein, Bill and I would later use it in our fledgling enterprise in traffic flow analysis. But I knew that this second-generation microchip could do much more, given the chance.
Readers, on the Book Report, we sometimes opt for lighthearted fun and preview books that are extremely accessible, but we also delve into books that collect awards like you and I collect seashells on the beach. So, without further hesitation, I bring you Jennifer Egan's A Visit from the Goon Squad, winner of the 2011 Pulitzer Prize for Fiction and National Book Critics Circle Award. Egan brings her unique gifts as a novelist and short story writer to a wonderfully listenable narrative. It's the story of Benny Salazar, an aging punk rocker and record executive, and the beautiful Sasha, the passionate, troubled young woman he employs. Benny and Sasha never discover each other's past, but the listener does, in intimate detail, along with the secret lives of a host of other people whose paths intersect with theirs in the course of nearly 50 years, in settings as diverse as the San Francisco music scene in the 70s, New York from the 90s onward, and a catastrophic safari in the heart of Africa. As a main character shares, the thing about punk rock is there's always some kind of adventure around the next corner until one day you wake up old, cold, and sold. Time marches forward, backward, and sideways in Egan's portrait of a once cool music empire now dwarfed by modern technology. The strange treat in this postmodern ensemble is newcomer narrator Roxana Ortega. A veteran of the soap opera scene, occasional improv comic, and supporting actress in films like Miss Congeniality 2, Ortega brings a surprisingly bold and wonderful solid set of voices to Egan's cast of haunted characters.
The couch where she lay in his office was blue leather and very soft. Kaz liked the couch, he'd told her, because it relieved them both of the burden of eye contact. You don't like eye contact? Sasha had asked. It seemed like a weird thing for a therapist to admit.
I find it tiring, he'd say. This way, we can both look where we want.
Where will you look? He smiled.
You can see my options.
Where do you usually look when people are on the couch?
Around the room, Kaz said. At the ceiling, into space.
Do you ever sleep?
No.
Sasha usually looked at the window, which faced the street, and tonight, as she continued her story, was rippled with rain. She'd glimpsed the wallet, tender and overripe as a peach. She'd plucked it from the woman's bag and slipped it into her own small handbag, which she'd zipped shut before the sound of peeing had stopped. She'd flicked open the bathroom door and floated back through the lobby to the bar. She and the wallet's owner had never seen each other. Pre-wallet, Sasha had been in the grip of a dire evening. Lame date, yet another, brooding behind dark bangs, sometimes glancing at the flat-screen TV, where a Jets game seemed to interest him more than Sasha's admittedly overhandled tales of Benny Salazar, her old boss, who was famous for founding the Sauzier record label, and who also, Sasha happened to know, sprinkled gold flakes into his coffee, as an aphrodisiac, she suspected, and sprayed pesticide in his armpits. Post-wallet, however, the scene tingled with mirthful possibility. Sasha felt the waiters eyeing her as she sidled back to the table, holding her handbag with its secret weight. She sat down and took a sip of her Melon Madness martini and cocked her head at Alex. She smiled her yes-no smile. Hello, she said. The yes-no smile was amazingly effective.
You're happy, Alex said.
I'm always happy, Sasha said. Sometimes I just forget. Alex had paid the bill while she was in the bathroom, clear proof that he'd been on the verge of aborting their date. Now he studied her.
You feel like going somewhere else?
They stood. Alex wore black cords and a white button-up shirt. He was a legal secretary. On email, he'd been fanciful, almost goofy, but in person, he seemed simultaneously anxious and bored. She could tell that he was in excellent shape, not from going to the gym, but from being young enough that his body was still imprinted with whatever sports he'd played in high school and college. Sasha, who was 35, had passed that point. Still, not even Kaz knew her real age. The closest anyone had come to guessing it was 31, and most put her in her 20s. She worked out daily and avoided the sun. Her online profiles all listed her as 28. As she followed Alex from the bar, she couldn't resist unzipping her purse and touching the fat green wallet just for a second, for the contraction it made her feel around her heart.
"You're aware of how the theft makes you feel," Kaz said, "to the point where you remind yourself of it to improve your mood. But do you think about how it makes the other person feel?"
Sasha tipped back her head to look at him. She made a point of doing this now and then, just to remind Kaz that she wasn't an idiot. She knew the question had a right answer. She and Kaz were collaborators, writing a story whose end had already been determined. She would get well. She would stop stealing from people and start caring again about the things that had once guided her. Music. The network of friends she'd made when she first came to New York. A set of goals she'd scrawled on a big sheet of newsprint and taped to the walls of her early apartments. Find a band to manage. Understand the news. Study Japanese. Practice the harp.
The youngest author included in the New Yorker's 20 Under 40 fiction issue last year is 25-year-old Tia Obrecht. Her highly anticipated debut novel, The Tiger's Wife, is living up to the deafening hype. It's an engrossing story, a masterful mix of realism and fantasy, exploring intricate themes of life, death, and wartime. It's set in the Balkans and tells the story of a special bond between Natalia Stefanovic and her recently deceased grandfather. Natalia is a physician, as was her grandfather. His sudden death in a village where he had no known ties sends her on a pilgrimage to understand the circumstances of his passing. Along the way, she remembers and discovers details of her grandfather's past, including two stories he told her when she was a child, one of a deathless man and another of an escaped tiger cared for by a deaf-mute girl. Susan Dwerden and Robin Sachs take you through the interwoven story with their mesmerizing narration. Let's listen.
The man has a broom and a dustpan on a long handle, and he is sweeping the area between the cage and the outer railing. He walks up and down, sweeping up juice boxes and candy wrappers, bits of popcorn people have tried to throw at the tigers. The tigers walk up and down with him. The woman in purple is saying something and smiling, and he smiles back at her. She has brown hair. The dustpan keeper stops and leans against the handle of his broom, and as he does so, the big tiger sweeps by, rubbing against the bars of the cage, rumbling, and the keeper puts a hand through the bars and touches its flank. For a moment, nothing. And then, pandemonium. The tiger rounds on him, and the woman shrieks, and suddenly the dustpan keeper's shoulder is between the bars, and he is twisting his head away and trying to reach for the outer railing so that he has something to hold on to. The tiger has the dustpan keeper's arm the way a dog holds a large bone, upright between his paws, gnawing on the top. Two men who have been standing by with children jump over the railing and grab the dustpan keeper's waist and flailing arm and try to pull him away. A third man jams his umbrella through the bars and pushes it over and over again into the tiger's ribs. An outraged scream from the tiger, and then it stands up on its hind legs and hugs the dustpan keeper's arm and shakes its head from side to side like it's pulling on rope. Its ears are flattened, and it is making a noise like a locomotive. The dustpan keeper's face is white, and this entire time he hasn't made a sound. Then suddenly, it's no longer worth it, and the tiger lets go. The three men fall away, and there is a splatter of blood. The tiger is lashing its tail, and the dustpan keeper is crawling under the outer railing and standing up. The woman in purple has vanished. My grandfather has not turned away. I am 4 years old, but he has not turned me away either. I see it all. And later, there is the fact that he wants me to have seen. Then the dustpan keeper is hurrying our way, winding a piece of torn shirt across his arm. He is red-faced and angry, on his way to the infirmary. At the time, I believe this is fear. But later, I will know it as embarrassment, as shame. The tigers, agitated, are lunging back and forth across the grate. The keeper is leaving a dark trail on the gravel behind him. As he passes us, my grandfather says,
"My God, you're a fool, aren't you?"
And the man says something in reply, something I know not to repeat. Instead, shrill and self-righteous in my lacquered boots, brave because my grandfather is holding my hand, I say,
"He's a fool, isn't he, Grandpa?"
But my grandfather is already walking after the dustpan keeper, pulling me along, calling for the man to stop so he can help him. Chapter 1. The Coast. The 40 days of the soul begin on the morning after death. That first night, before its 40 days begin, the soul lies still against sweated-on pillows and watches the living fold the hands and close the eyes, choke the room with smoke and silence to keep the new soul from the doors and the windows and the cracks in the floor so that it does not run out of the house like a river. The living know that, at daybreak, the soul will leave them and make its way to the places of its past, the schools and dormitories of its youth, army barracks and tenements, houses razed to the ground and rebuilt, places that recall love and guilt, difficulties and unbridled happiness, optimism and ecstasy, memories of grace meaningless to anyone else. And sometimes this journey will carry it so far for so long that it will forget to come back. For this reason, the living bring their own rituals to a standstill. To welcome the newly loosed spirit, the living will not clean, will not wash or tidy, will not remove the soul's belongings for 40 days, hoping that sentiment and longing will bring it home again.
Timely and extremely engrossing, the dressmaker of Khair Khana tells the story of Camilla Siddiqui of Kabul. After receiving a teaching degree during the Civil War, a rare achievement for any Afghan woman, Camilla was subsequently banned from school and confined to her home. When her father and brother were forced to flee the city, Camilla became the sole breadwinner for her 5 siblings. Armed with only grit and determination, she picked up a needle and thread and created a thriving business on her own. The dressmaker of Khair Khana chronicles this incredible true story of the unlikely entrepreneur who mobilized her community. ABC News reporter Gail Semach-Lemon spent years on the ground reporting Camilla's story, and the result is an unusually intimate and unsanitized look at the daily lives of women in Afghanistan. These women are not victims. They are the glue that hold the families together. They are the backbone and the heart of their nation. The dressmaker of Khair Khana moves beyond the headlines to tell a story of war, sisterhood, and resilience in the face of despair. Sarah Zimmerman narrates.
The sun shone brightly, and the scent of charred winter air, crisp but laced with fumes, went straight to my nose. I bumbled along, trying to keep Alia's wool scarf in place as I dragged my orange carry-on behind me. I had to stop every few feet to adjust my veil. No one had prepared me for how hard it was to stay covered while in motion, let alone while lugging heavy baggage. How did the women all around me manage it so gracefully? I wanted to be like them, but instead I looked ridiculous, a goofy foreign duckling fumbling among the local swans. I waited for an hour in the 1960s-style airport, mesmerized by the carcasses of Russian tanks that still sat along the side of the runway decades after the Soviets had left Afghanistan. I managed to get through the passport line quickly and without incident. So far, so good, I thought. But then, having gotten through customs, everyone around me quickly began to disperse in different directions, displaying a sense of purpose that I distinctly lacked. I felt a sharp stab of anxiety shoot through my stomach as I realized that I had no idea what to do or where to go. Journalists who travel to faraway and dangerous places usually work with fixers, local men and women who arrange their travel, interviews, and lodgings. Mine, a young man named Mohammed, was nowhere to be found. I fumbled through my wallet for his phone number, helpless and frightened, but trying to look cool and collected. Where could he be? I wondered. Had he forgotten the American, the former ABC News producer he had promised by email to pick up at the airport? At last I found his mobile number on a piece of crumpled paper at the bottom of my purse. But I had no way to call him. I had dutifully charged my UK cell phone, but my London SIM card didn't work here in Kabul. So much for preparation. 10 minutes went by, then 20. Still no Mohammed. I imagined myself, 5 days later, still stuck at the Kabul airport. As Afghan families cheerfully hurried out the glass doors, I felt more lonely than I had at 3 a.m. in Dubai's Terminal 2. Only the unsmiling British soldiers milling around massive NATO tanks in front of the airport brought me any comfort. Worst-case scenario, I thought, I could go to the Brits and ask them to take me in. Never before had I found the sight of a tank at an airport reassuring. Finally, I spotted a 20-something bearded man selling phone cards, candies, and juices at a little corner stand by the airport's front door. I broke out a $5 bill and a big smile and asked in English if I could use his phone. He smiled and handed it over. "Mohammed," I cried, shouting loudly to be certain he could hear me. "Hello? Hello, this is Gail, the American journalist. I am at the airport. Where are you?" "Hello, Gail," he said calmly. "I'm in the parking lot. I've been here the past 2 hours. We can't come any closer because of security. Just follow the crowds. I'll be waiting for you." Of course, security restrictions. How could I not have thought of that? I pushed my own overstuffed silver luggage cart the length of 2 football fields to a parking lot miles away from the NATO tanks and their British soldiers. There, as promised, was Mohammed, smiling warmly. "Welcome to Kabul," he said, grabbing my green Eddie Bauer duffel crammed full of headlamps, long johns, and wool blankets I had bought just for this trip. I wondered how many naive foreigners Mohammed had greeted at the airport like this. He had worked with journalists for years and was a journalist in his own right. A friend at CBS News in London had insisted I hire him because she knew he was professional, experienced, and trustworthy. Exactly what I would need in Kabul in the winter of 2005, a time when occasional rocket attacks and bombings had begun escalating into a full-blown insurgency. At that moment, I felt most grateful for her insistence. The streets of the Afghan capital were a cacophonous free-for-all, with crutch-bearing amputees, taped-together cars, donkeys, fuel-towing bicycles, and United Nations SUVs all fighting for the right-of-way with no traffic lights to guide them, and only a smattering of police governing their progress. The crunchy grime of the brown cobble air clung to everything.
Readers, if you listen to the show regularly, you know I am just crazy about Alexander McCall Smith and his number one ladies detective agency series. The latest, The Saturday Big Tent Wedding Party, is the 12th entry showcasing the humanity and warm wit that is our gentle heroine, Precious Ramotswe. In this title, Precious and her fearless assistant, Great Smakutsi, are puzzled by prophetic dreams. Precious finds herself investigating a case of rural jealousy while Grace inches closer to her long-awaited wedding. Even if you like your detectives hard-boiled, tough, cynical, and violent, you will still love Precious Ramotswe, our traditionally built heroine, and the cast of characters from city and countryside of Botswana. If you haven't read any in this series, set the scene and pick up the first one, the number one ladies detective agency. I promise you'll reach for more. This one is read by the charming Lisette Lecat.
"I am just a mechanic, Ramotswe. he had said to his wife. A mechanic is a man who fixes cars and other vehicles. That is what a mechanic does. Madame Otsway had listened politely, but her heart within her was a stone of fear. She knew that the fate of her van was at stake, and she would prefer not to know that. I think I understand what a mechanic does, Ra, she said. And you are a very good mechanic, quite capable of fixing it. She didn't finish. The normally mild Mr. J.L.B. Matukoni had raised a finger.
A mechanic, ma, he pronounced, is different from a miracle worker. A miracle worker is a person who works miracles. A mechanic cannot do that, and so, when the time comes for a vehicle to die, and they are mortal, ma, I can assure you, then he cannot wave a wand and make the car new again.
He paused, looking at her with the air of a doctor imparting bad news.
And so...
He had done his best for her, of course, and bought her a spanking new van, blue this time, with an array of buttons on the dashboard that she had not yet dared investigate, and with an engine so quiet and unobtrusive that it was sometimes possible to believe that it wasn't switched on at all, and that it was gravity alone, or some other mysterious force, that was propelling the van down the road. She tried to appear grateful, but it was hard. It was true that the point of a vehicle was to get you from one place to another without incident, but that, she thought, wasn't the only consideration. If efficiency were the only value in this life, then we would be content to eat bland but nutritious food every day, and the same food at that. That would keep us alive, but it would make for very dull mealtimes. And the same was true of transport. There was all the world of difference between travelling along a highway in an air-conditioned bus behind tinted glass and making the same journey by a side road on a cart pulled by a team of mules, with the morning air fresh against your face and the branches of the acacia trees brushing past so close that you could reach out to touch the delicate green leaves. There was all that difference. The tiny white van had gone to a scrap dealer, and that, she thought, was the end. But then she encountered a woman who told her that a nephew of hers had acquired the van and towed it up to his place near the Tule block. He loved tinkering, she said, and he might be able to do something with the parts that he could strip from the body of the van. That was all Madame Otsway heard, and nothing more. It was a better fate, perhaps, than that of total destruction in the jaws of some metal-crushing predator, but still she hoped that the young man who had bought the van for scrap might exercise his mechanical skills and restore it. And that possibility she kept in her mind, tucked away among the other scraps of hope of the sort that we go through life with, not thinking about them very much, but unwilling to let them fade away altogether. Now, on this crisp Botswana day, at the tail end of a winter that, for all its cold mornings, was still drenched in clear and constant sun, Madame Otsway was reminded of her former van by something she saw on the road.
How great that those lazy, crazy, hazy days of summer are here, with, fingers crossed, some extra time to read and relax. I'm hopeful you found a title or two for your beach reads list. For more hot titles, check my website, bookreportradio.com. I'm Elaine Charles. Thanks for listening, and please join us next week for The Book Report. Try my